listener, do you like scary movies? What's your favorite scary movie? Well, Jay and Mike like scary movies, too. You should go and subscribe to their podcast, We Watched a Movie. Because if you don't, I'll gut you like a... Well, I think you get the idea. Enjoy yourselves while you still can.
Hey, guys. Welcome back to We Watch a Movie. Mike here, and in this upcoming interview... So I wrote a piece for Bloody Disgusting about Frailty, directed by and starring Bill Paxton, as most of you guys know about the movie, that is. And I was given the opportunity after that to talk to David Kirshner, who produced and worked hand-in-hand with Bill Paxton making that movie. But he's not just produced that. He's produced everything in the Child's Play franchise. He's produced everything from Hocus Pocus to friggin' Fievel Goes West. So, I mean, there's a ton of stuff. He's a legendary producer. It was really cool to have this conversation with him, and he talks about everything from working with Bill Paxton, some really cool emotional stories about Bill Paxton and the other people that worked on that amazingly underrated movie, about the possibility of it coming to 4K, and even we talked about the possibility and his thoughts of Brad Dourif playing Charles Lee Ray in an all-Charles Lee Ray Chucky Child's Play prequel. So, all that is on here, and I want to thank David and Universal for having this conversation with me and for Bloody Disgusting. I hope you guys enjoy it.
Thank you guys for allowing me to do this. That was an amazing email to get to have that kind of feedback. Was really cool on that article, so I appreciate it.
Are you the author of that?
Yes.
Very nice article. Thank you.
Oh, no.
Bill would have been busting at his seams with pride. Bill Paxton.
Oh, wow. That's a true honor. That's an amazing honor. I'm a huge fan, and especially of that particular movie. Like we were just talking about just before this, about the dichotomy of all the stuff that you do as well, like going from kid stuff to the Child's Play and Frailty and the horror stuff. That's a wild jump back and forth. And then Hocus Pocus is like beautifully like right in the middle of that, you know. It's so cool.
I've always said this: by day, children and imagine. Children just imagine and pretend by day, but by night they have the darkest of imaginations of what's underneath the bed, what's in the closet, what are those shadows on my ceiling that are coming from my nightlight. And when Robert Louis Stevenson wrote Treasure Island, he was this host of European society. Everybody wanted him to attend their dinner party. And then he wrote The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and the London Times said he should be banned from polite society. And then he turned around and wrote A Children's Garden of Verses. And I think Walt Disney understood that with some of the scary and upsetting things that were in so many of the films that he did. And it continued with the likes of Lion King and Up, you know, of just loss and just that feeling. And, you know, I think Grimm certainly established that incredibly well. And so for me, I know most people think there's a giant difference in those worlds. I think those worlds blend, especially as night falls.
That's an amazing way to put that. And Frailty is another one that you were probably the perfect person to be involved with that, because it dealt with the children and the dad. And the scariest part to that for me, as I was talking about in the article, was when you're a kid and everything's fine, and then you go to sleep one night and your whole world just in the middle of the night, when he walks in that room and he's so happy about it, you know, he's telling them this awful, terrible, scary thing and just uprooted their entire lives, but was so happy about it. And then you had the young kid that trusted him and the older kid that was like, this is not normal.
Right.
I think that was the scariest actual moment of the movie for me.
Yeah. When Fenton says, my little boy world was turned upside down. And just a fantastic just sentence right there by Brent Hamley, who wrote that brilliant script. Such a talented guy.
That is something I wanted to ask you about that as well, because when I was going through and doing my research for that movie, I noticed that this was his first feature and then also his last feature, which just blew my mind. Like, you know, I was going to ask, I have no idea why in the world that would be. I didn't know if you had any insight to why there's no other credits there.
Yeah. For a couple of years, I did have an answer to that. And beyond that, I really don't. So here's what my answer was for those couple of years right after the film. I think for Brent, the response to the film was so great. The likes of Spielberg wanted to meet with him. Just every studio executive, everybody just loved the film. I mean, it really was upsetting, but they loved the film. And any meetings that I had with executives, they that was the film of all the films that I've made. That was the film that they had so many questions on, how much they would say how much they loved it. And I think that that kind of created, and this is from my point of view, a sophomore jinx for Brent Handley. I think that he was frightened to take the next step and do another film and or another screenplay. You know, I don't know privately if he wrote 12 more. I have no idea. But that I believe that the film kind of messed with him. And it wasn't box office success, but it was success by critics and success by the fact that everybody wanted to meet with him. And, you know, I wish it had been like that when we went out with it, because we couldn't sell it to any studio because of the subject matter. Children, murder in the name of God. I mean, you know, I mean, you couldn't put a worse group together in a box and bring it to a studio than the idea of these elements that are, I'm pretty sure studio execs felt they would not want to see it. And we were very, very fortunate that after my wife and I put a good deal of our own money into Frailty, that we had the White Knight come in of Lionsgate, and then they really rescued us and my marriage. So,
yeah, we were talking just before about how our partners become our new parents in regards to, like, the, you know, the stuff that you put up in the house, the horror stuff you put in the house and all stuff like that. So that's a great way to put that. It's so different to risk everything when it's just you than when you have somebody else as well.
Right. You and know? It's your nest egg for the future. Yes.
Absolutely. How did Frailty end up in your lap? Like, well, obviously not end up in your lap as an easy thing, so to speak, but you know what I mean? Like, how did it end up in your wheelhouse?
You're actually accurate with that. It actually did wind up in my lap. A development person that I work with named Karen Loop read it, and she turned to Corey, Cienega, who was one of the producers on it as well, and said, I think David's going to love this. It's children, it's horror, the mix is amazing, it's such a smart script. And Corey then told me about it after she read it and said, I think you're really going to love this. And I read it, and I truly, my mind was blown. I think more than anything that I've ever read to that point, my mind was blown of two worlds that I love so much. I love, as you said earlier, I love exploring childhood. I had this fantastic childhood until I was about 14 and my dad suddenly passed away, and then life changed in a very significant way. But I had this Norman Rockwell childhood. People always think I had this messed up childhood because of some of the movies that I've made. But I to me, so much of who we are as people today, as grownups, is certainly established in our childhood. And whether it's in animation or in horror or a mix of both, like Hocus Pocus, I just love putting worlds together like that and exploring childhood. And Fievel Mauskowitz from An American Tale, he was a child. Yes, he was an animated mouse, but it was childhood and the idea of loss, and parents think that he's dead and he's trying to find his family. And, you know, it could have been a live action story, but it was an animated story because it was animated mice. And so for me, it was just such a slam dunk to be able to take those worlds of the innocence of childhood. And one day dad, who's been a great dad, says, God came to visit me and the world is going to be coming to an end. And there are demons that walk amongst us, and he wants those demons dead. And it is our job to destroy those demons. You know, one son thinks, you know, man, dad is Thor. He's such a superhero. And the other one, as you said, just thinks dad's crazy and has lost it. And just the elements pushing against each other there. You know, how Brent came up with this is beyond me. I mean, he tells the story that he and his wife had some drug addictions. They were living in Tyler, Texas, which is where the story takes place. And he turned to his wife and said, baby, her name was Faith, which sounds like it's something from the movie.
Right.
And said, baby, we've got to get out of here. We're going to die. And they moved to Boston, and Brent got into the writing program at Emory. And he wrote that script, and he sent it to, he sent it out. And I think the response was great, but no one wanted to touch it. And that's when Karen Loop got it and brought it to Corey Sienega and me. And it's a world that I truly love, what he created there. And the casting was amazing. Bill was the first person on set every day, the last person to leave. I called him a Swiss Army knife because he was moving furniture. He was doing anything he could on that film. And as we go on, I'll tell you when you're ready about the editing process and James Cameron.
Oh, wow. That's not a name I expected to get. Well, I guess it does when it comes to with Bill,
yes,
for sure. And absolutely. And I can't wait to hear about that. I think the scariest part about the movie, apart from that, is also the fact that there's two scary narratives happening at once. Either Dad is telling the truth and, you know, God and angels are showing up to him underneath cars and having him, you know, serve his life murdering demons, or Dad is crazy and he's a murderer. Like, no matter where the movie was going to land, I feel like they're both almost equally awful for these kids' lives, at least. Was there any, when the script and the production and all that was going on, was there any question of where it was going to land? And also, did you guys receive any flack from the religious communities in regards to like the imagery and whatnot?
Well, I'll start with that. That you stated, I had to have LAPD protection because I was getting letters from the Christian Right delivered to our home with our two daughters at that point, saying they were going to put a bullet in my head. And what I had done, this is before the film even came out, which honestly makes no sense to me, because anybody that is that religious, and if you look at the First Testament, God is a smoting deity. This is a power that if you look at him the wrong way, you're going to either be turned to salt, you're going to be swallowed by an earthquake, you're going to be drowned in a flood. I mean, really violent stuff. And that's what inspired Brent. There was this Abraham and Isaac element to it. Right. Just to remind your listeners, in the Bible, God speaks to Abraham and says, I want you to prove your loyalty to me, and I want you to sacrifice your son. And man, Abraham's there with a knife in his hand about to do it on an altar. And that's when the angel stops him. And that as a little kid in Sunday school, that story was blew my mind. Like, what kind of God would ask someone to do something like that, to murder their child? And to me, it had those elements. You know, I mean, even when Bill Paxton, it's a great scene where they're, after they've murdered, Dad has murdered the sheriff, and they're digging a grave for him, Fenton goes off on him and just says, you're crazy. And Dad picks up a shovel because the weight of God is on his shoulders. God has asked him to do something, which is murder people, whether they be demons or not. And he's doing it, but there's great weight to that on him. As I said, the world is on his shoulders. The world of God is on his shoulders. And when Fenton questions him, he picks up a shovel, and he is going to beat his son to death with it. And that's when his other son speaks up and says, Dad, don't. And for whatever reason, Dad listens to him. But it's that Abraham and Isaac moment for me. And it really, I just thought it was so smart. And I had never read a script like that before or after.
Yeah, it's exactly what I thought of. I think he even mentions, I believe, in the movie, he mentions, I think at some point, that passage or whatever it is in the Bible. And that's why I'm not surprised actually to hear. I actually am a little bit surprised to hear that the religious group, I guess before it came out, it makes more sense. It could be a damnation of that kind of ideal, or it could be a supportive kind of ideal of that kind of ideal. But also, I think the best part of it is that it walks the line in between. You know what I mean? It doesn't actually tell you.
It doesn't. And that to me is something that I'm very proud of, that it makes people walk out. And we would, after screenings, we would walk out. Bill and I would go to different theaters and we would just stand in the lobby and you just hear people. Bill was kind of in disguise. For me, it wasn't a problem, but we would just stand there and listen to people, and they would argue over the fact of, no, God really did come to Dad and the world is going to end in this movie. And others just saying, no, Dad was crazy. And I love that. And I don't know the answer to this. I'd like to believe that God did come to him. I think that's really cool. I'm not sure what I believe in, but the idea in this world that God did come to him, I think that's pretty great.
Yeah. And I think that's a great thing about it, is that you can pretty much, you know, take it, even though he's seeing those things and he knows those things, there's always something to explain. You could always, you know, I think they did a really good job. You guys did a really good job of that. Was there ever any other ending, or like, did that change at all throughout, or was the ending always kind of the ending through that whole thing?
You know, and this is where I was going with the James Cameron of it all. We were editing, Bill and I and our editor, Arnie Glassman, wonderful man who's sadly since passed away as well. And Bill said that Jim Cameron's going to come by, as he said, Jim's going to come by and kind of look at the film and give me some thoughts. And, whoa, okay, that's exciting. So James does come. And he looks at the film and he just said, you know, I think it's really, really good. But in the beginning, there are some scenes that, you know, because it starts in more present day and then flashes back to the 70s. And James had said, I think you should move this from the end and move it to the beginning. And I think that will make the end that much more succinct. And we weren't even clear what he was talking about, neither Bill nor I or Arnie. And he said, can I just show you? And boom, you know, this guy's brilliant. He's on a movieola and he does everything and puts it together. And we look at it and it changed the entire film. I mean, it changed the entire film. And as Bill said, that's why he's James Cameron. And it was a moment that I felt like such a fanboy just sitting there and watching Jim look at this, take it all in and make the subtle change that completely changed the end, so that you weren't sure what it was. Was Dad crazy, or was Dad literally speaking to God? And James Cameron deserves enormous credit for that. And Bill does for bringing him in. I'll tell you something interesting. Bill came to my house for lunch. He had read the script. He liked the part of Dad. It was just being offered to him to play Dad. I wanted somebody that the baggage they brought in a Tom Hanks way was just great. People just loved him, loved his characters that he had been in over the years. Bill fit into that perfectly. You know, Bill was very much a dude, and so many fanboys, fangirls just loved his persona. And I just thought that would be great there. Okay. And Bill comes to the house and he's got his saddlebag. He always had his saddlebags with him. And we're having lunch at the house. And he said, boy, it's going to take a really interesting director to make this film work right. He said, I do not want to be tainted with the brush that painted Anthony Perkins as a psycho, because it destroyed his career. And he said, so it's, you know, it's very subtle stuff here. And I said, I agree. And I really wanted Bill. And I just said, look, something I don't usually say to actors, we'll make that decision together. I will keep you informed on the director and you give me your input. And Bill said, well, David, he says, I was thinking I'd like to direct it. And I'm smiling and shaking my head, but inside I'm thinking, oh shit, what do I do now? We're having lunch together. He's here. He wants to play dad, but now he's saying he wants to direct it as well. And I'm a million miles an hour. These thoughts are going through my head. What am I going to say to this guy? And he said, let me just show you a couple things that I'm thinking. And most people don't know this about Bill. He was a really good artist. And he storyboarded key scenes of the entire film by himself. Just phenomenal. I wish I had those storyboards. I'm sure Louise's wife does, but he storyboarded it all. And then he pulled out also from these saddlebags art books that because he was talking about palettes of color that would be right for the film and what would make a character pop against it. Clearly a cinema fan, someone that loved the history of cinema, but really knew what he was talking about. I was blown away. I did not expect that at all. And when I went to Lionsgate to say, you know, Bill said he'd like to direct this. They said, well, has he ever directed anything? I can't think of anything that he's directed. And he really hadn't. I think he did one little short or something, but nothing anybody had ever seen. But they really didn't fight it. They were so supportive of the entire film. At one point we were making the film, he said a guy by the name of Michael Pasternak was head of all production, a great guy. And I said to him, is there a problem with what you're seeing with the film? And he said, no, not at all. Why? And I said, because you guys never come to the set. And he said, we don't need to come to the set. We're looking at the dailies and they're good. If they weren't good, we'd be at the set every day. And, you know, here Bill is doing his first film, James. And this is what a studio was saying. No, we're going to stay away because we're so thrilled with what we're seeing. So I think the only wish, if I had a wish that I had would be that if we could make that film or have the opportunity to make it and then turn around and really have a marketing of the film. Because Lionsgate said to me that we just were not ready for this kind of film. They had not hit their horror world yet. They had not done Saw or any of those. And they were just getting their feet in the water. And though they did a great job on the poster and trailers, it really wasn't out there. And I think that hurt us because most people didn't even know it existed.
Yeah. And it's a strange movie. It's a unicorn in a way that, by the way, that's a fantastic story. Thank you for sharing that with me. That's amazing to hear about Bill Paxton and all that. But I mean, it's a unicorn in a way that, like, I think everybody's so they have their strong opinions about everything this or that way, but whenever Frailty's brought up, it's always the same. Oh shit. I love that movie. Like, that movie's not talked about. Like, I never hear an unkind word about the movie. And that when it came out in 2001, right? Like 22 years ago, I felt like as a viewer, it came out at a time where you were just skeptical of everything you watched, especially if there was a twist. It was right after not Signs, but Sixth Sense came out. So anything with a twist was like looked at, you know, and picked apart. And I think that was just one of those movies that a lot of us didn't get to us until DVD. But when we saw it, it was just like it was a crowd pleaser in the living room, so to speak. Like, everybody was like, no, that was good. That was awesome. I can't believe I haven't heard of that until now. But that's an amazing story. And I heard Patrick said that you still have Otis even hanging in your office.
I it's normally on the wall, but I brought it here.
That's amazing.
And there's Otis on there. And what you wrote was correct about Bill naming it Otis. A lot of people online, interestingly, I don't know if you've ever seen this, James, but a lot of people have said that Otis in chat rooms and such, anytime you go to a department store or a building, you get in an elevator and you look down and on the threshold, it says Otis.
Oh,
and all of these people, I mean, it's across, it may be the world, but certainly the United States, almost 90 something percent of elevators you get in say Otis. And people were saying that the reason that it was named that by the filmmakers, and it really wasn't the filmmakers, it was the filmmaker Bill Paxton that did it, was because those elevators go up towards heaven or go down towards hell. And I have no idea where that came from, but in truth, Bill came across a homeless guy whose name was Otis, and he was fascinated by the idea of this. Bill loved little homily kind of stories and people that weren't the shiny people. He really was fascinated by what lay in the shadows and the sadness of life. And he would just go talk to people. And though I wasn't with him when he met this guy, Otis, it just stuck with him. And he just said, I don't want it just to be an axe. I want the axe to say Otis on it. And I just thought that was so cool. Such a great touch.
That's really cool. That's amazing. And I've also read the same theories. I haven't heard the elevator one, which is fascinating. I knew that he had spoken to a homeless person or something like that, that was named Otis. And then I've also heard that it stands for the acronym for Only the Innocent Survive. And also that's actually the dad's name, since he's only credited as dad, that his name is Otis, which would make it crazy, because if he saw an axe inscribed Otis, that kind of like takes the question work out there. Like, oh, he's definitely being sent from God.
Man, you've given me chills up and down my arm and down my spine with that. I had never heard that, but I love that. And I love, what did you say it stands for again?
Otis? Only the innocent survive is what I read. That was just a fan theory, not mine. But
that's phenomenal. I wish we would have incorporated that into the film. I love that. Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. And I did want to ask you too, when you said that James Cameron moved a part from the end to the beginning to keep it in question, do you remember which part it was specifically?
It was when he goes to the FBI at the beginning of the film, and there's some dialogue there, and he moved things around, and that dialogue then appeared at the end with when dad, the last person that he's going to kill is the FBI agent himself. Sorry, anybody hasn't seen it, but here this FBI agent has been so doubtful of all these stories, and he's going to take him, one of the sons, Fenton, is going to take him out and show him where the bodies are buried, and he takes him out there to kill him. And I mean, it's such a surprise, and Powers Booth is so phenomenal in through the whole film in that scene. But Bill had worshipped Powers Booth, and the idea of him working with him, you know, by the way, Powers Booth, a Texan, Bill, a Texan, and Matthew, of course, a Texan. So that was pretty cool to see those weave together in the story in this little town of Tyler, Texas.
Yeah, it was almost the little movie that could in a lot of ways, because like I know Matthew McConaughey, it was before like the McConaissance or whatever you call it, where everybody kind of looked at him as like the guy that he is now. Yeah, but before the Oscar.
He has said this film is what got him Dallas Buyers Club, which he won the Academy Award for.
Yeah.
And, I don't know if he was just being nice or what, but, he kind of had been doing, you know, he started off, obviously, what was the film that he did? Dazed and Confused. And, you know, and then from there, he started doing some really great films. He did the film with Jodie Foster that Robert Zemeckis directed about space and remember the name.
Contact. I was trying to think of it too.
Yeah. Contact. But then he started doing all these, the ghost of a, I don't know how, what the number was of boyfriends past and, you know, lots of like that. And he was just kind of being relegated to kind of the hunk that was in those rom-com movies. And then then there was the opportunity to do this. And boy, he threw himself into it. And I knew he'd be good. He was a really good actor, but I had no idea that he would deliver what he delivered. Both of them, you know, that scene that I spoke about in the Rose Garden, where they're digging the grave for the sheriff that dad has killed, because dad has found out, or the sheriff has found out what dad is doing, and he has no choice but to kill him. And you just see again the weight of the world on his shoulders, and he's digging that grave, and that's, he picks up the shovel and he's going to kill his son. The other son stops him, and he drops it, and he drops to the ground, and he's sobbing. He's just sobbing and sobbing. And so the camera's rolling, Bill is on the ground sobbing and sobbing, and it's going on for about 20 seconds of sobbing. I mean, it went on for quite a while. And then all of a sudden from down there, you hear Bill just, you know, he's covered like this, and you hear him say, cut, cut, okay, cut, you know, and the guy's really crying, and he's so in the moment of the scene, and yet he's directing the scene. Yeah. And I mean, I just remember, it brought tears to my eyes with just the passion that he had for that whole project and the scene and how seriously he took it. I think Bill, you know, so sadly in so many ways, but Bill, God, he just could have directed so many other great films. And I know from there, and maybe it was sophomore jinx for him too, it took him a couple of years. He was being offered a lot of stuff. And then he finally took a film, it just didn't work out for him. It was a rough go, and it was so different than what he had just done with us, or 2 years before had done with us. And I think there was some kind of sophomore jinx that he wanted to stay away from that because he didn't think he could outdo himself, which I personally think he could have.
Then that was a question I was going to ask you eventually as well. Like the other movie, The Greatest Game Ever Played, it was the golf movie that he did, which is, like you said, it's such a departure from Frailty, you know, but I wondered that myself. It's one of those things you go and you look at the credits for this and you're like, well, how did he never direct a movie again? But that makes so much sense. But that, I think something that's so special about him that made Frailty so perfect for him, because a lot of times, you know, he wasn't the leading man. He was a character actor, which, you know, is a beautiful thing. And I think of, at least for my, you know, lifespan of movies where I go back to, I think he's the greatest character actor of all time, you know, just in my opinion for my lifetime. But that movie only would have worked if it was a guy who could passably be, you know, a dad who goes to work and he comes home and he has a single beer, the Hams, you know, beer, and then takes care of his kids and is just like an everyday guy, but also has the ability to turn it up in those other moments. And I think that's just why he worked so well as an actor, is like, you could believe him. He was a dude you wanted to have a beer with, and yet he had the talent of all like the superstars. So it was such a cool thing to watch him actually get to be, you know, front and center for that.
And just to be, aside from the producer, but just to be a fly on the wall on when we shot this film, the stream of people that came to visit him, and from actors to Ray Mazurek, who is the keyboardist, to the Doors. I mean, it was just a stream of fascinating people that were in Bill's life that were coming to root him on and watch him. It's something I will never forget for the rest of my life. The gift of being able to work with him, be in his presence. That was pretty darn great. He was very proud of the film.
Yeah. And I hope that he, even if it didn't do what it should have done box office wise, I hope in the end he saw the response of people once it came back around. And that happens so often to great films like John Carpenter's The Thing. There's all these movies that people just don't understand, or the marketing's not there for them. They don't know how to market it. They come back around, but then it gets that second life and becomes a classic. I feel like Frailty is that, you know?
Yeah. For us on Hocus Pocus, it was that, a film that bombed and barely made any money, and then has since grown into this juggernaut that Disney just announced the third one. So when that happens, which is rare, it's exciting.
Oh, I know my kids. Yeah. I watched the first one when I was a kid, and then my kids were super stoked. this past year to sit around the TV and watch the second one as well. And we're almost out of time, but I got to ask you, speaking of Second Life, so the movie and it being on home video, do you think, I know that like when stuff, because like speaking of James Cameron, like somehow like Terminator's not on 4K, you know, The Abyss, you can't even find it anywhere. And these are like great classics. Sometimes it seems like now with 4K movies, when they come out, it actually is a little bit of an event. Do you see any, do you think there's any hope for a future for Frailty to show up on 4K?
I don't know the answer to that. Maybe after our discussion here, and if enough people make noise online, that would be the case. So please, that would be wonderful to see, because I sure would love to see that and own that.
Oh yeah, so would fans. I can promise you that. I know I would. Do you ever see? Because that's what I think. I think when I think of character actors like Bill Paxton, not to just put him in that box as a character actor, but you know what I mean. I also think of Brad Dourif.
And
yeah, they're similar to me, and you know, in their in the way that they connect with people. What have you ever considered or thought about what it'd be like to have a full prequel, so to speak? I know they've touched on it in the TV series, but like have a full, if Chucky wasn't even there, full Charles Lee Ray story go out in some form or fashion.
Absolutely. I would absolutely love to see, and I discussed this with Universal just recently. It's so funny you're saying this, the idea of a prequel. But Chucky does not appear in it. But Charles Lee Ray, and I mean, in the world that you inhabit, you know this, but I don't know if your listeners do. Charles Lee Ray is, those were the names of people that terrorized me when I was a kid. Charles is Charles Manson. Lee is Lee Harvey Oswald, who shot Kennedy. And Ray is James Earl Ray, who shot Martin Luther King. And those guys, they had, I don't know what it is, but they had an effect on my childhood. And so that was the name that I dubbed him for the series. So the idea of this, and he was a Manson-like character. He was this manipulative, very bright. He just knew how to play the chessboard so well. And I would love to see the events leading up to that night where he dies in the toy store, and the scene right before and when you see Brad Dourif kill his supposed partner in crime, Eddie Caputo. And yes, I would love to see that. I'm you know, Universal said, oh, that's interesting, that's really interesting, and that's where we are at the moment. So my hope is that we can do a version of that, and before Brad gets too much older, and do some work digitally to make him younger for those particular scenes that we would need him to be that much younger for.
That's awesome to hear. Yeah, I've always wanted to see that since that first scene in Child's Play. I'm like, man, I'm way more interested, honestly, in the serial killer that he was before that scene even took place, almost, you know. So that's awesome to hear.
I'm with you before he became that doll. And you know, who else had died and how had they died? And Don Mancini explores in our TV series the childhood. And Don said something so interesting, and that is he didn't want to see this messed up childhood that Charles Lee Ray had. He wanted him to have a just perfectly normal, loving childhood, but he's a bad seed. He was born evil. And I thought that was really interesting, as opposed to just saying, yes, but look how he grew up. And, you know, Charles Manson's mother was a prostitute and there were drugs involved. And you say, and you could say, you know, what she did was horrendous, but look at his childhood. Don didn't want any of that. Don wanted him to have a perfect childhood, because some people are just born evil.
I think it's scarier that way. Honestly, it goes back to the whole Michael Myers thing with the original and then Rob Zombie's version. I like both versions, but in Rob Zombie's version, he kind of grew up in that sort of trailer trashy home and had all that stuff, bad stuff happen. So it gave him a reason. So in that way, it just made it less scarier than this kid who just snapped one day for no reason whatsoever. It's like all it was pure evil that way. So that's fascinating. I love it. And I so appreciative you've taken the time to talk to me today. This is
amazing. This has been so exciting for me. And I was truly thrilled. So thank you. I really appreciate your time. And I'm smiling because I of you of all people, I think it's great that your kids love Hocus Pocus. But I always say that it's your child's first horror film. So the fact that your children are watching, it makes me smile. Because they will be brought up on a steady diet, I'm sure, with dad of introducing them at the right time to things that go bump in the night and that are so scary. And and you're the perfect dad for that.
I appreciate it. Yeah, no, my 13-year-old tags along with me to every single one I go to. I always check on a couple things, make sure those aren't in the film. But most of it, yeah, I'm like, I know. I grew up watching it, so I know what you can see, you know, what you can and can't. So, right. Yeah, no, I appreciate your career and everything that you've done. And I called my wife immediately. It was that kind of moment for me. I was like, this is so cool that this guy actually wants to talk to me. So just to let you know, that's kind of how it was for me. And I really appreciate your time.
James, thank you so much. I appreciate yours. And keep the memory of Bill Paxton and Frailty alive.
100%. Hopefully we can get people talking about that 4K.
Yes, yeah, please. You've got the power.
We'll do all we can.
Thank you so much.
Right. Thank you. Have a great
Take
day.
Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.